right, it is the Reef Threads Podcast 197. I'm still Gary.
I'm Christine.
Yes. Boy, I heard immediately last week when I talked about hearing somebody say that they had programmed their controller to send them an email every morning so that they would know it was functioning. Immediately, I heard from Sanjay that it was him.
Yes.
So, what was it? That was me. Yeah. Okay. So it was Sanjay. So, restating, Sanjay in his talk said that as part of trying to eliminate problems in the with his controller and not being informed when his tank gets too hot and all kinds of things, he has his controller now email him every morning basically to say, I'm here, I'm working, everything's fine. Which, and of course, then I heard from two others. I felt like I was getting scolded after a while.
Duh, it's Sanjay.
Yeah, pay attention. But yeah, it made me think, though, about this whole thing. You know, you put these controllers in and try to automate these things. And when you have a 500-gallon tank and related systems like Sanjay does, you almost have to automate because your whole life will be sucked up by running the tank if you don't start automating some things. But it puts now another burden on you to keep up with the software, to keep up with any updates, or if the system is down, if it's an internet-based thing where you get notified on your phone or your computer or whatever, you have to keep up. And that was one of the things, is Sanjay had not been around and had not gotten the notice or had not read the notice that that email notification was not working and they were working on it. So it adds another element of responsibility to the system. As you try to eliminate responsibility by automating, you now have to keep up with the software and the online service.
Right.
And I guess at some point now you're putting a little responsibility on the company that provides the controller and provides the software that drives it and whatever servers and so on and so forth. So it's like everything else. There's nothing easy. It's nothing clean and simple. But there's one more thing you have to pay attention to. So
yeah, I think that it's, we think that if we add a controller that everything's going to be fine. And it just means we have a different way of monitoring what is not fine.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yep. And you do, with systems like he's using, you do have, no matter where you're at, and he's gone a lot, you at least are getting notified.
Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah, not he's gone and somebody happens to go downstairs and notice that something's amiss. People like him almost have to have that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're getting notification. So anyway, it was Sanjay. Yay, Sanjay. and then learned that apparently for some time the Reef Threads podcasts have been available on the Reefs.com app, which I did not know.
There you go.
We learned at MACNA from Josh that they've been available for some time. So yet another reason to have that Reefs.com app on your phone. We've said it before, he's really built up a powerful little app there that offers a whole lot of information and services for free, Android or iOS, and all right on your phone. It's I think it's great.
Yeah, Josh has put a tremendous amount of work into this app and the whole system and the Reefs.com site. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, he really has built it up, and it's content. It's not flaky stuff. I mean, it's solid content all the way throughout. Some of it a little entertaining for my taste, but in general, it's good, solid content. And then you have Reefs Magazine coming out quarterly, and that's always, it's always first. When that comes out, I'm on it right now reading.
Yeah, yeah.
And because there's always good stuff in there. And, yeah, it's a between that and Advanced Aquarist, I would say for blog type things, two of the best.
I would agree.
It's been interesting to watch over the years how these various blogs have evolved. Where Josh is offering a variety of things through different channels. In Advanced Aquarist, you're getting more and more, can I say, research-oriented articles, a little deeper articles that I enjoy reading. It's a different flavor. And Aqua Nerd does a nice job with tips and kind of a mixture of products and stuff. And but it's Advanced Aquarist, I guess, is where I read quite a bit of that. That's there's some pretty good stuff there and Reefs Magazine. So it's just interesting to watch these blogs evolve, and I am always impressed that these guys keep doing them too.
Yeah. I like when you get some more in-depth pieces, you know, like Advanced Aquarist seems to do that maybe a little better because they're more long format type articles versus the blog posts at reefs.com, which are often more of bites than they are full articles. But that said, there's been a couple of pieces recently by Chris Maupin from Texas, which have been really, really good treatises on some scientific papers that have come out recently. So I think, you know, it kind of shifts over time.
Yeah, and I'm not selling anyone short. I keep track of them all. We both do because there's good information in them. Yeah, it's you do get much more of a mix out of Reefs.com, and we do get some of that stuff, but the more in-depth stuff, Advanced Aquarist, and I just enjoy them all. I guess
it depends on when you're reading them. You know, if you have time to sort of sit and go through a full article, or if you're just kind of browsing the internet and just need a quick something that's interesting.
Yeah. Yep. I got to talk about this is just bothering me. It won't go away. I didn't want to bring it up last week because it was kind of a downer, but it just keeps bothering me. And this is the Magna Banquet. This year was bothersome to me, because of the content that was presented at the beginning and then presented partway through, basically taking shots at Rich Ross, all in good fun, I guess. I've said it to you, and I think I said it after the Cousteau thing 2 or 3 years ago where I was bothered by it. The Magna Banquet, to me, it's the biggest event of the year. Magna's the biggest event of the year, and it's, to me, Saturday night, the banquet is kind of the culmination, if you will, of the year of reefing for those of us who actually go to Magna, and it's a culmination and should be a celebration in as much as you can celebrate, you know, have a celebration. But I think it should just be a positive thing all the way around. And I was really bothered, and I'm going to sound really prudish and no fun, but I was really...
You're no fun, Gary.
Yeah, well, I've been accused of that before, so what? But I was really bothered by the content, and a lot of it was, it was funny if you're part of an inner circle and part of a connected group of people. But I was sitting with a group of people that were halfway or more back in the room, and there was a lot of people there. It was a big double banquet room.
And it was 1,400 people or something like that.
Yeah, it was a lot of people. And I was halfway back, and the sound was not all that good, and so you weren't quite getting some of the jokes, and a lot of them were kind of more inside than they needed to be, and then you had pictures up on the screen that were definitely, they made people uncomfortable. I could just tell. And It just bothered me that we were sitting through this stuff and people really couldn't hear, and a lot of people just eventually checked out. But I kind of was doing a look around and saw an awful lot of kids there, and I look at the people who come, and it's mostly guys who come to Magna. I mean, it's mostly guys who are in the hobby. But then a Magna kind of thing is a chance in many instances to bring your wife or girlfriend and a chance to bring your family in Denver, you know, a beautiful town, and so you bring your family and tack on a day and go see some mountains and do some things. And you know, can you, to your wife or girlfriend, can you come to the banquet with me? It's, you know, it's really cool. They have these awards and then there's always a speaker at the end and, you know, and then they get there and they're subjected to this kind of stuff. And it just really bothered me a lot that I think you have to, if you're putting together a banquet like that for a group like that, and you have to think about all of the people, the entire overall audience, and how it reaches them and the message it sends to them about our hobby and the people who are organizing the event. And you want them to enjoy the evening. You don't want the wife going, "What is this stuff? And, you know, why don't we need to leave?" And, it just made me uncomfortable, and it won't go away. It just won't leave me alone. And it made me uncomfortable this time in one way. And then when we had Cousteau, who was not a fan and is not a fan of this hobby, and he was kind of tap dancing a little bit because I think he realized once he stood up there, he had the wrong attitude for the wrong crowd. That made a lot of people uncomfortable in a different way. And you just have to think about that. And then I really felt bad for the speaker at the end. I don't remember his name, but talking about
Luis Rocha.
Yes, Luis. He had an excellent talk, and during the day it would have been really good. But after a long day and everybody's doing all this stuff, to start talking about genetics and hybridization and stuff it was really unfortunate. I hung in there as long as I could, but most of the people had left. I mean, there were not very many people left when he said, "Now to part three of my talk." There were just not very many people, and I felt bad for him. He was a real trooper. He hung in there, and did a good job with his talk, and it was interesting stuff. But again, it was just not the kind of thing there's got to be a little entertainment there, and a little energy. And so the whole thing was just, I really hope that next year's people will look harder at what they're doing with that banquet.
I think it's different, so I have a different perspective. I was in a different part of the hall than you were, and I wasn't sitting with people that were part of that, that were part of what you would call the inner circle, really. It was just a random smattering of people, and pretty much everybody in that section was having an enjoyable time. And the way I look at it is this. First of all, Mitch Carl did the MC, and I think he did a fabulous job because Mitch did exactly what he was told to do, which was to be Mitch. And anybody that's known Mitch or has seen one of Mitch's regular talks knows that it's not going to be something you would give a third grade class unless, you know, you're an unusual person. It didn't bother me in the least. I can see your point about a lot of the jokes being, you know, directed towards a particular bunch of people. But that's what it is. And sometimes, you know, those kind of jokes have been going on through lectures for years. I mean, all of us will do that. We'll put a slide in that's, you know, a dig at one of the other speakers, or we'll do something funny like that. And it's always been completely acceptable. So all Mitch did was kind of collect that whole genre and put it all together into one thing. And the people who organized this knew exactly what they were getting. So I think Mitch did an excellent job of doing exactly what he was expected to do. As far as people being uncomfortable, with the sort of sexual or offensive nature of things, I had a very interesting discussion about sort of this after on Sunday, and somebody who was mentioned in Mitch's talk, had said, you know, I felt really weird because I felt like I was being sort of, you know, made fun of in kind of an inappropriate sort of, you know, sexual way. And I said to this man, I said, well, now you know how it feels to be me or any other woman in the hobby, because on a regular basis, we are women in a men's hobby, and there's a lot of off-color jokes, and there's a lot of sort of, you know, pat you on the head, sweetheart kind of jokes, or, you know, kind of sexual innuendo kind of jokes that may make you uncomfortable. But if you're part of this group, you can choose to either roll with it or cause a giant fuss. And different women have different strategies. But I found it ironic that this man suddenly felt like he was, you know, the shoe was on the other foot. Oh. And I don't know if he got it, but this is pretty much par for the course for us. So the fact that it was a man on the other end of that for once, I felt completely comfortable because I've experienced it for years. So for me, maybe that was eye-opening, you know? Maybe having it switched for once was a good thing in, you know, in the long run. Maybe everybody feeling a little not so good will make people think twice about how they speak to each other in general. So I am of the opinion that maybe that was a good side effect. I don't think that was Mitch's intention by any stretch. But the fact that it did happen that way, and the fact that somebody felt uncomfortable in ways that a lot of women feel uncomfortable a lot of the time, was kind of a nice thing.
Yeah, and that, you know, that's really just, I think, sad. I know that kind of thing goes on in with women, and you know, if a woman's in the crowd, you know, the jokes and whatnot, that just ignoring the fact that there's a woman around. I mean, that stuff always makes me uncomfortable. I don't know. I guess I'm just weird like that. I mean, I hope I've never done that, but it bothers me. And the minute I knew that Mitch was going to be the speaker, I was pretty confident where things were going to go, because that's just Mitch.
That's Mitch. That's his sense of humor.
And you know, and if that's what it was, well, that's what we want out of you, Mitch. Well, then that's, you know, that's the fault of the people that put him there.
Well, the people that chose both the banquet speaker and the MC knew both of those people well, so they knew what they were getting. So, like I said, Mitch did an excellent job of doing exactly what it was that was expected of him. And so if you put aside what you think that thing should be, and you look at just the job that he did, regardless of whether you thought it was appropriate or not, he did a great job. You know, the question of whether this was the right venue for what he did is a question that, to me, sits solely on the shoulders of the organizers. So that's kind of...
Yeah, won't disagree with you on that. Whether he did a great job or not, I just really feel like anybody who stands up there in that position needs to look at the bigger crowd and make sure that they're appropriate. It's you're basically the face of the hobby at that moment, and I just didn't enjoy it. I didn't appreciate it, and I think it was a good portion of why so many people did leave. I think it was a turnoff for a lot of people, and maybe I'm just making some assumptions that have no basis, which is probably the case. But I mean, just people just kind of flooded out of there after the dinner was over. I mean, it was just the place just got emptied, and that's not the way I don't think that's the way the banquet should be. And maybe there's a different formula. I mean, was it when did Richard Pyle talk? Was it 2 years ago?
Last year
he was. And, oh, what a fantastic talk. Oh, boy, I'll tell you. I mean, he just had me locked in and riveted through the whole thing. And even there, you know, people were leaving. So, you know, it raises the question. Maybe people just simply don't want a keynote speaker after the banquet. But people, you know, people who left Richard Pyle's talk missed out. Absolutely
right.
Missed out.
I think, again, speaking for the area that I was in, the reason that people were leaving, I didn't hear anything about content. People were leaving because the banquet speaker was about to start, and it was almost 10 o'clock. It was late. So it was more of a matter of do I want to sit in this chair for another 2 hours, or do I want to go do something else? That was what I heard. I didn't really hear anything about content, but again, I was in a different place with different people.
Yeah, well, And all I was going by was body language all around me, because it was making me uncomfortable, and I started looking around to see how other people were reacting, and people were tuning Mitch out, and the first chance they saw to leave, people were up and leaving, and it's just unfortunate. I just really wish that the evening had not gone that way. That to me was not the celebration, and maybe that's not the right word, but it's the way I feel about it. The celebration that banquet should be, and I really feel like people should walk out of that banquet excited and having really had an enjoyable evening. And yeah, it was late. There's no doubt about it. It was late, and yeah, people want to go have a drink, or people are just flat tired and want to go back and go to bed, you know, whatever it might be. And if they had kids, then they definitely needed to head out. And
yeah, it's a long day at that point. We're going on 14 hours at 10 o'clock.
Well, and your mountain time. So, for me, it was, an hour, and for you, 2 hours of difference.
And altitude. That's, well, so many people I spoke to afterwards, especially people that were working the trade show floor, were like, is it me or is it just exhausting this year?
Yeah, no, well, it was.
It's both.
And you don't, okay, so I just hope next year that some serious thought is put into that banquet, and serious thought is put into the impact and impact it has on the greater audience, the whole room full of people, and the picture it paints of the hobby. I really hope that an effort is put into that. And
yeah, you know what it strikes me too about this whole thing is that it's all Rich Ross's fault. It truly is. Because
okay.
No, hear me out, because
you tap dance out of that one.
Rich was the MC last year, and he did a fabulous job. But Rich has been doing this. This was Rich's career, where he did exactly that for corporate events and things like that. So Rich has years of experience doing exactly this sort of thing. So he got up and he made it look really, really easy, like anybody could do it, because he's just so seamless. And, you know, he gets up and it's basically what Rich is like all the time. And he just made it look like, you know, anybody could do this.
And I need to note, he did all of that without sex, without any off-color stuff.
But Rich also has had the benefit of years of feedback on what he has said. And, you know, I've seen Rich do some things, you know, some different event type things. And, you know, sometimes he veers into the inappropriate, but he's had the experience of having years of seeing what things he can float and what things he can't, and, you know, being able to choose when he's going to use each type of thing. Mitch got up and did this because somebody asked him to. He had no experience with this. And the fact of it is, getting up in front of 1,400 people and trying to be funny is really, really hard.
Yes, it is.
It's really difficult. So, you know, the idea of somebody even having the courage to get up in front of all those people and try it, I think is pretty amazing. So, you know, if Rich didn't make it look so easy, maybe the organizers wouldn't have said, well, we'll just get, you know, somebody else to do it and it'll be great. So thanks, Rich. Gary says thanks, and it's all your fault.
Yeah, I didn't say it was his fault. I mean, yeah, it is hard. It's darn hard to be funny in general, but especially in front of a group like that and have material that is going to be funny to a majority of people. It's darn hard to do. It takes talent and, like you said, experience and all those things. Mitch didn't have that ability, and to be put up there and basically be, well, I don't know. It just bothers me. It will continue to bother me. I'll get over it at some point. You know, I'll get over it at some point, but it just, I just want more. I expect more. And, people buy those tickets and plane flights and hotels and all those things. And I just really think that 2 or 3 hour stretch there should be much stronger than it was this year by a long shot. So, all right, enough cranking about that.
What would you recommend then So you didn't like this. What would be your choice? How would you do it differently?
I mean, I obviously put Rich Ross back up there again as an easy out. I don't know that it needs to be all that entertaining, the front end, because if you think about it, the front end of the banquet is basically we've got to announce the scholarship winners and the Aquarist of the Year, and do it while dinner's being served. And that can all be fairly short and fairly well done, you know, without shortchanging anyone, and then not have it be so late for a keynote speaker. But then that keynote speaker has to have some entertainment value, has to have, I mean, Richard Pyle was a classic example. You know, he's got a rebreather diving video chasing coelacanths, and that whole thing is just absolutely riveting, and you have to have some kind of entertainment at that hour of the night to keep people locked in. Otherwise, they'll just check out. And I think we need to get to that. We need to have an entertaining thing, and we need to get to that faster. And unless you're going to have Rich Ross up there or someone of his caliber who can entertain people and entertain the greater room. But other than that, the front end of the banquet is dinner and some fairly functional things. We've got some awards to give out and recognize the scholarship winners and say thanks to the sponsors of the dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not take a shot at the sponsors' products while we're doing that. Let's acknowledge the people who put up a lot of money so we can have a nice dinner. All the costs for the room and everything, I mean, they need to be thanked and acknowledged because Marineland every year, puts up whatever they have to put up. And I'm sure it's a chunk of money to sponsor that dinner, and they should be appreciated because not everybody can do that or is willing to do that. I think that's when you ask that question. Yeah, I think we if we don't have someone who can be entertaining like Rich, we need to get in, get the business done, get dinner done, and have an entertaining cap to the day. And not an hour, you know, a half hour thing, and then everybody's out of there. I think people would generally feel better about it. And maybe, you know, maybe I'm completely wrong on this thing. Maybe everybody walked out of there happy as a clam in sand. Maybe that, you know, maybe I'm just dead wrong. But I doubt it because that room emptied out. And I mean, when I left, if there was 60 or 70 people left in that room, well, the keynote talk was going on, I'd be surprised. And that's, you know, 1,400 people down to that. That's saying something to me.
Well, there you go. I think you should do it next year, Gary.
Yeah, probably not. Well, we could do it. Well, I don't know I don't know that we'd be funny or entertaining.
Know that I would be more appropriate, quite frankly.
No, I think you would.
I'm from New York, Gary.
We could carry the function. Well, okay. You can use that too. I don't think that's a reason or an excuse either way. I mean, there's certain material that belongs in certain places, and that was not it. So, all right. That's 30 minutes of me cranking.
There you go. Let's talk about some fish.
Yeah, like Archer fish.
Yes. So Archer fish are so cool.
Your basic marine fish.
yes. So, right. They just, you know, they're just like every other fish. They just swim back and forth. The Archer fish, which you got to see at Steinhardt, is the coolest
aquarium display ever.
Yeah. So the Archer fish actually will eat insects that are above the water. And so what they do is they spit a very rapid stream of water towards an insect that they see with great accuracy and knock it right out of the air and onto the water, and then they gobble it up. So there was an article from National Geographic which actually describes some research that went into how it is that they're able to be so accurate with their shots, considering that the water is going to refract light, or vice versa, the air is going to refract light differently than it travels through water. Either way, what they see is not where they where they think it is if they're going at any sort of an angle, as anybody knows that's stood in a swimming pool. So what they were able to figure out by tracing how the fish fish this way was that they mostly will shoot straight from directly underneath. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting is that in order to get a stream of water over time, but to have the impact that they are that is required to actually knock the insect out of water, they change the shape of their mouth to increase the speed of the water ejecting so that the beginning water is going a little slower than the end water. So all the water ends up at the insect at the same time. So it just it's just one wallop of water knocking this bug down. So I think that's pretty interesting. One, that they've figured out, you know, they say fish are not that smart, but to me that's showing some pretty creative use of a tool, quite frankly. You know, when you talk about which species are smarter, birds, people, because of their ability to use tools, dolphins is one too, because some use sponges. But to me, this is a tool. You know, they're using water. Just because it's all around them doesn't mean it's not a tool. So I don't know. I think that was pretty neat.
Yeah, and they even said that, that it qualifies as a tool because using what they'd use the example, if you throw a stick, that's not a tool. If you sharpen the stick and throw it, that's a tool.
Right.
And so the archer fish, if you spit water, that's one thing, but they're going beyond that. They're manipulating the water.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore it becomes a tool. And so now we're looking at fish, a 4-inch maximum fish using a tool to catch food. That's just flat impressive. And
yeah,
and then yeah, and then to talk what the quote in there, if you get hit in the face with a water jet from one of these fish, it stings like an insect bite.
Yeah, that would make sense. So it really is forming one unique bolus like that.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
And to watch them, I mean, that display that Rich has at the Steinhardt Aquarium, and he'll put some crickets in there, and they're crawling on the branches. And those archer fish, man, they're just knocking them off one right after the other.
It's
amazing to watch. And what they said in this research, that the water hits with 10 times the force, a force 10 times greater than the insects are using to hang on to a branch or something. So that's a pretty good punch. And that's really neat. I'll see. And I made a little video when I was at the Steinhardt of the archer fish, because we talked about these before. And I'll see if I can dig that up again and put a link on the page so people can watch them work if they've never seen them. But, if you get to the Steinhardt, just camp out in front of the archer fish aquarium because it's riveting. Beg somebody to feed them. That's good research. I love this kind of research where people say, how is this simple, seemingly simple thing done? And then when you look into it, it's just flat out impressive. They're not just squirting just spitting water. There's so much more to it. That's neat.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's pretty awesome.
Good stuff. Rich, this is like Rich Ross night.
Well, you know, see, this is the thing, you know, you get all upset at Mitch for talking about Rich all night. And here you are, Gary, talking about Rich all night.
Well,
I
hope that we are talking about Rich in a much more positive way than he was talked about at the banquet. He does this at the Reefs magazine, Skeptical Reef Keeping. The one I have here is number 11. He's done 11 of these articles about skeptical reef keeping. And the whole concept there is don't just accept what people say. Don't accept anecdotal evidence. Don't just use products because someone said they're good, but evaluate them yourself. Basically think about what you're doing rather than just blindly going forward. So he's been writing these articles for some time now, and I never miss one. They're good thinking in all of them. And this time it's the ethics of animal selection. And really some good points here about this whole concept of us buying animals. And we've talked about it a million times about, you know, research your animals. Don't get in to do an impulse buy. But right at the beginning here, that he talks about how animals in stores are set up, that it creates an environment that just basically drives you to make an impulse buy and give you instant gratification. And it's really true. I mean, but that's marketing. I mean, that's marketing anywhere. I mean, that's what all stores want you to do. They want you to just grab stuff off the shelf. But that is making us feel that somehow, for various reasons, any animal is worth a try in any tank. And that made me think back to my early days of marine animal keeping, where I put a French angel in a 29-gallon tank. And that one has always stuck with me, because as I learned more and got more experience, that one has always bothered me, because I doomed that animal to death, you know, all those years ago because of an impulse buy.
Because you didn't know.
I didn't know. I didn't learn. And there was certainly not going to be anybody at the fish store stopping me. And I wanted that beautiful angel, that black and yellow, beautifully shaped angel in my tank. And if it was going to get to be the size of a pie plate, I didn't care. And, and I know I bought that fish, brought it home, and then looked up to see what I bought. The very reverse of what it should be. And that fish has always stuck in my head, because I did that fish wrong. I should have never done that, but it was an impulse buy. I just had to have that fish, and always has bothered me. But I guess that's a good thing, in that that here now, I don't know, 25 years from now then, later, it still bothers me. That
right, because you have a conscience, and because you're actually trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, yeah, and it does. I mean, it's legit. I'm not making it up. It just legitimately bothers me. But it was an impulse buy. And then coupled with that is a statement he makes later on in the article, the mentality that no one has ever seen this fish before, I better buy it before anyone else does. How many times have you either done that or been tempted? You know, a new shipment comes in, there's an unusual fish, got to have it.
Not me. I don't.
You're
really,
so restrained.
No, it's not a matter of restraint. It's a matter of what is appealing to me, and the rarity of an item does not in any way make me want it more or less. That's just me. I just don't have that collector bug. I'm very, very happy with the most common things. It just doesn't appeal to me for that reason. You know, that said, for me, if I saw a fish that was something that had a really interesting behavior, or that you could build habitat around, that for me would be a draw. That would be an impulse buy. But just the rarity of it, or, you know, to say I have something doesn't really do it for me.
Yet I would submit that for a large number of aquarists, that's what moves a lot of animals.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it drives a lot of the, it drives a lot of the hobby from a livestock side, but also from a hardware side as well.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And then here was another thing that we've talked about in one way or another, but under his intent thing, where people seem to accept losses when an aquarist has done due diligence and made every effort. But then the aquarist is basically condemned if he's sloppy or not viewed as making an effort to keep that animal alive. And, yeah, probably true, huh? Probably true.
I think so. You know, loss is part of life. It's part of every kind of life. And, you know, when you take a fish or a coral into your care, you have to be willing to accept the fact that, you know, things die. You're dealing with living animals. We're not, you know, doing model railroad things where there's no consequences. So you do the very best you can. And I think the part of it that we do, I think the thing that we could improve the most as a hobby collective is preparation work. So it's not so much even the after you've got the animal. I think that what we don't do well as a hobby is, because of this whole impulse thing, is preparing for an animal's arrival. So do we choose a fish and then go and build an ecosystem around it, or do we build an ecosystem and shove fish in it that we happen to like at the time? So I think that a lot of losses could be prevented by making better choices ahead of the fish's arrival, if we're talking about fish, corals, whatever, it doesn't matter, and by preparing for its arrival in other ways, by making sure that you have proper food supply, making sure that you quarantine, doing all of those things that you need to do. So, yeah, I think preparation is maybe one of the best things we can do.
And part of this whole thing of taking animals into aquariums and keeping them and fish die and corals die, yes, they do. And it's sometimes I think there's, for those who are critics of the hobby, they make an assumption that if all of those animals had been left in the ocean, they would all be alive today. And the food chain doesn't even allow that.
No.
No, I mean, animals die all the time. They're food. It's the old circle of life thing. And, you know, but I think there's that mentality that if 50 fish out of a herd of 50,000 were not collected, then those 50, in addition to the other 50,000, would all still be alive 24 hours later, and not the case. And they get eaten. You know, they become food, they die, all kinds of things happen. And there's just, to me, from the critical people's point of view, it's like, fish and corals would be alive, they would never die. It's just, if we just leave them alone, they'd never die. So I don't know, I'm just in a mood.
You are a little cranky, yeah, today, Gary.
A little bit testy and definitely cranky. Yep, I'll admit it. Oh, and then he does some numbers with a American Pet Products Association research survey that they did that indicates that there are approximately 700,000 saltwater home aquariums in the U.S. And then Rich does some very conservative number work with that and ends up, and I'm not going to go through it all because you can read the article, ends up that conservatively saying that there are about 200,000 people on online saltwater communities in the U.S. And of course, the assumption is those are the people who are making the effort to get good advice, and we know that doesn't happen very often. So 200,000 out of 700,000 owners of aquariums. And you know, those numbers, I mean, there's a wide range of error there, but it gets the point home, are involved in reef forums trying to get information in one way or another and getting good or bad depending on the thing. So then, as he says, you got basically 500,000 saltwater marine aquarium keepers floundering around, not knowing anything and or relying on other sources for their information. And it's an interesting thing, but it also makes an assumption. Well, no, it doesn't. You're suggesting or indicating that maybe forums are the way that people get information, which it is the way they get information. The question is, how valid is most of that information? And, you know, how many people actually read books? Not as many as used to be. But that's a pretty big difference. That what do you say? 500,000 people groping along in the dark, alone with only their neighbors, big box pet stores, and tarot readings from which to get information.
Right. I think it's kind of interesting that we see a little bit of a contrast here. So we've got on one hand somebody talking about the internet as being something you should be aware of. And basically the gist of it is, you know, be careful of the information you read because it's written by idiots, who may or may not know what they're talking about. But then in contrast to that, we went to a talk by John Chiodi, which was on aquascaping, and he talked about it from a very different light. And in his talk, he was talking about aquascaping with the idea that, you know, you're going to post this on the internet. So aquascape a three-dimensional thing to make it look good in two dimensions. So on one hand, we've got somebody talking about the beware of the internet side, and on the other end, we've got somebody talking about the great benefit of the internet and how it's such an integral part of the hobby. You know, it just basically accepting that, yes, we all live on the internet in the hobby and to some degree, so we should just, you know, accept that fact and work with it. So I think it's good to kind of talk about it from both ways.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's why we do these podcasts every week too. I mean, that's the original concept of Reef Threads, and why it's called Reef Threads is
right.
Is take this information we find in the forums and in the blogs and comment on it. And you know, we're not experts by any stretch, but comment on it, give our thoughts on it. And my original ridiculously idealistic thinking when this was started was that by giving links to those threads and forums, and that we would help start a discussion and further the discussion on those forums. And that never materialized, but I think we, from what we hear from people that, and there's a lot of people who listen to us, that it does get them thinking, whether we're right or wrong, at least it gives them some food for thought. And that's far more important than, and really is what Rich is saying. You know, let's think about these things. Let's just don't accept them as fact just because it's written on some forum. There's really very few people who write in the forums that you can pretty much take their opinions to the bank. Probably can count on one hand the number of people that do that. This is just a good one. This is a good article. Rich always thinking and always making us think, and it's worth. That's just a small part of this article, and of course all the other skeptical thinking articles he's done. Now 11 of them. If you've not read them, reefs.com, go read them. There's one in, well, it's just about every Reefs magazine for the last couple of years anyway, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I don't think he's missed one more, maybe more than one or two. So good stuff to read and just to keep yourself objective and make sure you're asking questions before you spend money or do something in your tanks. So, all right, I'm done being cranky. That's it.
Well, I'm done listening to you be cranky.
I'll bring Gary. A better attitude next week.
Yes, please.
That's it. Reef Threads Podcast 197. We'll be back.